Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone should require assistance during the workshop, please press star, then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Senior Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Rob, and I too would like to welcome everyone to today's program. This is a partnership program between the Longevity Foundation and Cancer Care, and the title of the program is Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer for Caregivers, and is part three of Living with Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer. Now, today's program is supported by Bristol Myers Squibb and Regeneron, and I really want to thank them for their support of this program today. Now, I'd like to tell you a little bit about who's listening today. We have over 150 participants on the call today, and you come mostly from the United States, from both urban, rural, suburban, and frontier communities. And we also have international participants from Canada, Israel, the Philippines, Romania, South Africa, and the United Kingdom. So this is a global call as well, and it's a credit to each of you that you've chosen to spend this next hour with us. And now it is my pleasure to introduce our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Bobak Parang, and Dr. Parang is Assistant Attending Physician, Division of Hematology and Oncology, Weill Cornell Medicine, New York Presbyterian. And Dr. Parang will be addressing an overview of non-small cell lung cancer, the important role of the caregiver in communicating with the healthcare team, the caregiver's role in decision-making for a loved one with non-small cell lung cancer, and the increasing role of telehealth, telemedicine appointments. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Dr. Parang.
Hello, and good afternoon, everybody. My name is Bobak Parang. I'm a physician scientist at Weill Cornell Medicine in New York, where my clinical and scientific focus is on lung cancer. It's a real pleasure to be here with everyone today and to start the session off. I just wanted to first kind of start out broadly and zoom out and give us a framework for the ensuing discussion by first just asking what is lung cancer, and then I wanted to narrow in on the importance of caregivers and provide a few illustrative examples of how important that role is. So for the first question, you know, what is lung cancer? This is just simply a cancer that arises from the cells of the lung. So cells are just basic microscopic units of our bodies that provide some specialized function. And we have about a trillion cells in our body, and they all, each of them, contain DNA or genes. And these genes provide instructions for how the cell operates. So we have hundreds of different types of cells in our bodies that provide a variety of different functions. We have liver cells, we have brain cells, colon cells, et cetera. Our lung cells line our airways, and they help us absorb oxygen, they help us cough, they help us fight off bacteria and viruses. And in normal situations, these lung cells divide and they grow in order to repair themselves and keep our lungs working. And they grow and divide in a highly coordinated manner. So how do they know when to grow and when to stop? Well, the instructions are in each of the cell's DNA or genes. You can use DNA or gene interchangeably. But sometimes that DNA becomes mutated or it becomes damaged, and now the instructions have been changed. So that lung cell that used to grow in a coordinated manner now follows errant instructions and sort of goes rogue and begins to grow and divide without regard for its environment, and then it becomes cancer. So lung cancer happens when the cells lining our lungs acquire a mutation in their DNA or genes. And these mutations erroneously activate them to grow and divide in an unchecked manner. So broadly speaking, there are two types of lung cancers. There's small cell and non-small cell. And these names simply refer to how the tumor cells look under the microscope about 100 years ago. So one tumor type is composed of small cells, and the other is composed of non-small cells. Now, non-small cell lung cancer, which is what we're talking about today, you know, makes up about 85% of all lung cancer diagnoses. And non-small cell lung cancer can roughly be divided into three types of categories. There's adenocarcinoma, there's squamous cell carcinoma, and large cell carcinoma. And adenocarcinoma and squamous cell make up about 85% of all of those cases. The remaining 10 to 20% are large cell. And again, keep in mind, these are all, these names just all refer to how the tumor cells look under the microscope. So how is non-small cell lung cancer diagnosed? Usually someone has a mass that's found on a CAT scan or a CT scan, and that leads to a biopsy, which is when a doctor places a needle into the tumor and takes a chunk of it. Then a pathologist looks at that piece of tumor under the microscope and tells us what it looks like, if it looks like adenocarcinoma, squamous cell carcinoma, or large cell. And then the pathologist does some additional testing, including having the tumor DNA sequenced, and this allows us to detect any genetic mutations within the tumor. So let's say we have a diagnosis of non-small cell lung cancer. What's next? How do we treat? The first thing we do after a diagnosis of lung cancer is we, quote, stage the lung cancer. That means we try to really define where the lung cancer is and the extent to which it has spread. Is the tumor only in the lung? Has it spread to other organs? These are really critical questions because it informs our treatment options. And this staging part of the diagnosis usually involves additional CAT scans or PET scans or MRIs. And again, all this is really to clarify where the cancer is. Now, roughly speaking, lung cancers that are stage 1 through 3, so 1, 2, 3, are, quote, local or have not spread outside of the lung. And stage 4 is lung cancer that has spread outside of the lung to another organ or to other sites within the lung. So once a patient is staged, the next question really is, what does the treatment look like? And broadly speaking, there are two types of treatment. First, there's local treatment like surgery or radiation, where we treat a tumor that is one area, that is in one area, either by surgically cutting it out or by irradiating it. These treatments are performed by surgical oncologists and radiation oncologists. The second type of treatment is, quote, systemic treatment, meaning that the treatment goes all throughout the body and kills tumor cells wherever they may be. This is usually a pill or a medicine that is given through the vein. And this type of treatment is given by a medical oncologist like myself. And then there's within the systemic treatments, there's sort of three buckets. There's chemotherapy, which is medication usually given through the veins, and this acts directly by killing cancer cells. The second bucket of treatment is immunotherapy, and this is also an infusion through the veins, and it activates your immune system to go and then kill the cancer cells. And then the third bucket is a, quote, target therapy. These are pills that can selectively target cancer cells that have a specific DNA mutation. So let's just put everything together here. If a patient has lung cancer that's confined to one area, that means that we can perform surgery or radiation. But if it's spread out to other areas, we usually do a systemic treatment that can go throughout the body. So that's a general framework for how we approach non-small cell lung cancer. And you know, as you can see, there's a lot of different types, and there's different stages of non-small cell lung cancer, and there's different types of treatments for different stages. And really, almost every year, we're adding more treatments that are available to use. So where does the role of the caregiver come into play? Well, this is a lot of information for anyone to absorb, and it's a lot of information for us oncologists to keep up with, much less someone who was just diagnosed with lung cancer. So caregivers like you are really, really important for not only providing social support for your loved one or friend or family member, but to also communicate with the medical team. And I want to just discuss three specific really important ways you can do, ways you can support your loved one. And for the sake of time, I'm just going to mention these three. So first and most importantly, being there for your family or friend who is experiencing this life-altering diagnosis, that is the most important thing. So do not underestimate how much your presence alone helps absorb the weight of this diagnosis. If you can do one thing and only one thing, simply being there is a huge, huge benefit. And this does not have to be in person necessarily. If you can't make your appointment, you can dial in or video conference call or just be put on speaker. So your presence, either virtually or in person, is valuable on its own. The second way you can support your loved one is to ask questions. So cancer diagnoses bring profound uncertainty, and having some knowledge provides some stability for both the patient and family and friends. If you don't understand something the oncologist said, then ask. Don't be shy. There is truly no dumb question, and it's also okay to repeat the same question several times. So I just want to suggest five quick questions that I think everybody should ask in addition to any questions that you've you have yourself with your oncologist. And this is taken from a really great article by a physician named Dr. Christopher Booth. If you Google this, Dr. Christopher Booth questions a patient should ask, it'll pop up the first thing. So the first question is ask them, what lung cancer do I have and what is the stage? This gives you a framework to work with. Second question I would ask is my cancer curable? The third question I would ask is, will my treatment help me live longer? And if so, weeks, months, or years? The fourth question I would ask is, what are the side effects of the treatment and what are my options, my other options? The fifth question I would ask is, where will I spend my time in the next 6 months? In other words, does the treatment that you're recommending mean that I'm going to need several days in the hospital because of a surgery? Does it mean I'm going to be in the infusion clinic every few weeks for 6 hours? Or does it mean I'm taking a pill at home and I'm just going to see you once every month? So if you only ask those five questions, you will still leave the clinic visit with a good framework. Third, the last thing I'll say is it's really critical that one of the most important roles you have as a caregiver is to communicate with the medical team if your loved one is feeling well or unwell. Sometimes patients don't tell us something that is bothering them for various reasons. Sometimes they're exhausted. Sometimes they're just having a bad day. Or, more often than not, sometimes we oncologists do not ask the right questions or frame the question correctly to extract the appropriate information from the patient. But it's really important for us to know if something is wrong. If the patient isn't feeling well, if they're down, if they have questions. And oftentimes caregivers know better than the patient. I mean, you know the patient better than we do and often better than the patient themselves know. So if your loved one is not feeling well, we need to know so we can get to the bottom of it to make them feel better. And conversely, if your loved one is doing really well, that tell us too, because that's all invaluable. So to bring this all home, you know, lung cancer is really complicated. Being a patient is complicated. Your role as a caregiver is really invaluable, not only to provide social and emotional support, but also to help clarify what the treatment plan looks like. And I'll just close with this, you know, be kind to yourself. Being a patient is really hard, but so is being a caregiver. There are really unique challenges to shouldering the burden of someone close to you. So you need a break too. Thanks again for listening. I'm happy to answer any questions in the Q&A coming up.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Perang. That was a really fantastic presentation and really very much, you know, provided so much information to our participants in a way that people could understand, and also giving people, of course, those questions that they could ask their doctor. And also, I think, I know there'll be a lot of questions for you during the Q&A, and because you're the first speaker, you really set the stage for today's program. So I really want to thank you very much, and I know you'll be getting lots of questions during the Q&A, so thank you so much. And our next speaker is Angela James, and Angela James is both an oncology social worker, and she also has an MBA and other degrees as well. And she's a care navigator at Longevity Foundation. And what she'll be discussing is what research tells us about caregivers, challenges in communicating with the healthcare team, challenges and rewards of caregiving, coping with each day on special occasions and birthdays, Longevity Foundation's free programs and services. And she'll also give you information about their website and how to get information, all the information from their website as well. It's really my great pleasure now to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. James.
Thank you so much, Carolyn. I'm so happy to be here. Welcome, caregivers. I'll start by just sharing, like Carolyn said, some research. Caregivers can be partners, family members, or close friends, and many times you are the lifeline of the person with cancer. For many, caregiving is a role that's willingly taken on, yet there is a growing body of evidence that shows us that providing family care is not without strain to a caregiver's own quality of life. This support can often be physically, emotionally, socially, and financially draining. This is why identifying support and resources can be imperative to caregivers. I will be sharing more support services and resources at the end of my presentation. Many caregivers also find themselves working closely with their cancer care team. They're doing things like giving medications to the patients, handling side effects, reporting problems to the medical team, and helping to decide if a treatment is working. Establishing and maintaining communications that include the patient and caregiver as an equal member of the healthcare team reportedly can make the difference between adequate care and missed care. Some challenges in communicating with our healthcare team can include fear and shock. In other words, patients, caregivers may find it difficult to talk openly with their doctor and other team members after a cancer diagnosis. It can be the medical jargon. In other words, patients or caregivers may not understand the language that's being used by their healthcare providers. There could be language or culture barriers or just simply unclear expectations. In other words, patients may feel unsure about who to ask questions to and when to ask them. This is where a caregiver can ask for a patient navigator to help further communications with your doctor and your healthcare team. A patient navigator can guide you through the healthcare system and help you communicate with your healthcare team so you get the information you need to make decisions about your loved one's care. And though these responsibilities can be overwhelming and stressful, caregivers also reported that they have found them to be very rewarding. Most caregivers agree that the experiences change their lives. Some of the rewards that the caregivers have reported include feeling a close bond with the person with cancer, finding added meaning to life, finding new strength, and developing a new appreciation for family and friendships. Speaking of family and friendships, caregivers also look for different ways to cope throughout the holidays, even through every day, as it can be challenging to balance caregiving responsibilities while preparing for upcoming holidays or special occasions. Talk to your loved one about the holidays to see how they would like to celebrate, and you can make a plan together. And if you're that family member who, say, makes the best potato salad for the 4th of July, please know that it's okay to say, no, not this time. It's okay to buy a dish or a meal or a store-bought dinner from a restaurant, or even cater a holiday if you choose to cater the holiday meal. You could also suggest that everyone bring a dish and complete the meal this way. It's totally okay to make adjustments for all of your holiday celebrations. And the main thing is, don't forget to take time out for yourself, even if it's just a walk down the street. It's so very important to acknowledge your feelings as well. Try not to hold in all your feelings. Share them with someone you trust, such as a loved one or a professional counselor. And always recognize that you're doing your best and acknowledge your efforts. And at this time, I'd like to share a few resources from Longevity Foundation with you. We have a lung cancer helpline. That number is 844-360-5864. Again, it's 844-360-5864. That lung cancer helpline offers free personalized support for patients and caregivers. The oncology social workers are fluent in both English and Spanish, and they have available resources to help manage emotional, financial, and support challenges during the journey. Longevity also has educational materials available in English and Spanish. They're readily available to read on our website, or you can order them, and we will ship them out to you at no cost. On our website, we have video and a webinar library where you can browse video content covering topics like education, support programs, survivor stories, and so much more. we have a Lifeline mentoring program where we can match patients and caregivers with one-on-one mentors. That is somebody that you can reach out to. You guys can speak over the phone, email, however you choose, and that can like be your person that you can bounce your feelings off of or just vent and have someone to talk to. We also can match people in our clinical trial ambassador program. Those are people who have gone through a clinical trial and they can share their experience with you and help you know what to expect if you choose to go through a clinical trial with your loved one. We have various Facebook communities. We have a caregiver group that we facilitate each month. It's every fourth Thursday of each month. It's virtually on Zoom. We also have the patient survivor meetups that we hold all week. Actually, I am the facilitator for our caregiver group, and we have a survivorship nurse navigator that facilitates the survivors groups all week long. These survivor groups can be oncogene types, which is EGFR, F+, KRAS, no mutation. We have a small cell virtual group as well. We offer lung cancer 101 information on our website. It's a comprehensive guide to understanding the basics of lung cancer, how lung cancer develops, how it can be found, and the different types of lung cancer. We also have launched our patient gateways. This is where patients and their loved ones can go straight to our site and learn more about their specific cancer. You'll also find that we have a clinical trial finder on our website. You enter your geographic location and your type of location, and it will find the trials that are available to you. A lot of people have questions about nutrition and what they should be eating. We have an intelligent nutrition assistant, also called INA. This is on our website. It's available 24/7 for on-demand support with nutrition answers, tips, and recipes to help patients feel better, maintain their strength, and speed their recovery. You can also use INA with your cell phone. You can simply text her a question, and she will text you back the answer. We host two survivorship conferences each year. Our Hope Summit, which is usually in the spring, and it's a conference designed to inform, connect, and empower anyone who's been affected by lung cancer. It is a true celebration for patients, survivors, and caregivers with a focus on living well with lung cancer. We also have coming up September 20th and 21st, our International Lung Cancer Survivorship Conference. This is our virtual education conference for people with lung cancer, caregivers, and advocates. This conference provides opportunities for attendees to hear from world-renowned researchers on the latest in treatments, learn about ways to manage your lung cancer and treatment journey, and find hope in today's scientific progress. You can find all of this information on longevity.org. We are also on various social media, Facebook, X, formerly known as Twitter, LinkedIn, and LinkedIn under Longevity Foundation, as well as TikTok. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much. That was fantastic, Ms. James. That was a wonderful presentation and really, really loaded with information and tips. I just want to let everybody know that any of the information we give out that involves like a phone number or website or anything like that, we're going to also send that to you. You'll be getting a SurveyMonkey evaluation of the program in about a week. And it's an evaluation of the program, which we always appreciate people filling out. But it also will include any resource that we mentioned. So although you may have written down numbers and things like that, you're going to have them also in the SurveyMonkey evaluation. So basically stay tuned. That's really so important. And now our next speaker, so thank you so much, Ms. James. I know there will be lots of questions for you during the Q&A as well. And our next speaker is Ms. Dina Smith, and Ms. Smith is an oncology social worker. She's our caregiver, cancer care caregiver program coordinator at Cancer Care, and she'll be addressing challenges and rewards of caregiving, taking on the role of caregiver, managing family and friends and long distance caregiving, self-care tips for managing the stress of caregiving, Cancer Care's free programs and services, and she'll be giving out information about how to call us on the telephone, our Hope Line number, and also our website as well. So I'm now going to turn this program over to my esteemed colleague, Ms. Smith.
Thank you so much, Dr. Messner. So I want to start out by recognizing that caregiving can look, feel, and mean different things for different people. So you can be a short-distance caregiver, meaning you're either in the same household or living in the same town as your loved one, or you could be a long-distance caregiver, such as you're living across state or even across the country from your loved one. You could be a child to the cancer patient, a spouse to the cancer patient, or even a parent to the cancer patient. You may be more of an emotional caregiver, such as lending an ear or a shoulder to cry on, or a practical caregiver, meaning you transport your loved one to and from doctor's appointments, or you administer medication, or perhaps you're a combination of both an emotional and practical caregiver. But no matter how you identify, there is no right or wrong way to be a caregiver, and remember that any effort that you are putting into the caregiving process is definitely more than enough. Each type of caregiving comes with its own stressors, of course. So your relationship with your loved one may change due to the diagnosis. Your daily responsibilities or priorities may change. Maybe you're taking on a whole lot more now. I oftentimes tell caregivers that becoming a caregiver is equal to kind of taking on another full-time job in a way. Your annual traditions and get-togethers may look very different, and you may experience symptoms of burnout, such as fatigue, sleep changes, weight or appetite fluctuations, sadness, loneliness, anxiousness. But remember, there are so many ways to alleviate stress. So I encourage you to carve out time for yourself each and every day. And if you can't do it every day, at least try to do it once a week. Take out your calendar or your smartphone calendar and make sure that you plug in at least 15 to 30 minutes per day, and if not per day, per week, of something that you can do just for yourself. Be prepared and organized. So ask the oncologist questions, write down appointments, reach out to friends and family members if you need. I highly recommend using the websites My Cancer Circle and Lots of Helping Hands, as these are great platforms in which you can organize and show others exactly what your schedule and your loved one's schedules look like and what type of help you'll need. I encourage you to always exercise as much as you can, eat healthy foods, seek individual and or group counseling services, and my favorite, say yes to yourself and say no to others. This is not a selfish act. Prioritizing yourself will in turn help you show up for your loved one better and show up for yourself better and show up for friends and family better. In addition, I encourage you to practice meditative exercises. So some of my favorites consist of box breathing, where you inhale through your nose for 4 counts, hold the breath for 4 counts, exhale through your mouth for 4 counts, hold for 4 counts, and repeat. You can also try a body scan. And I encourage you to look on YouTube for this, or even smartphone apps such as Headspace or Calm, where you can find scripts that'll guide you through a nice body scan. These can be as short as 5 minutes. I've also seen ones as long as an hour. You could also try guided imagery. And again, you could find these scripts on Headspace, Calm, or YouTube, where a calming voice will guide you through a pleasant image, such as drifting on a cloud or even at the beach. Additionally, considering how much information you want to share with family and friends is yet another form of self-care and alleviating stress. So I definitely advise you to set boundaries. you and your loved one may want to disclose the diagnosis to only a few people. You may want to disclose it to a lot of people, or you may not want to disclose it at all. But to the people that you do disclose the information to, maybe you should ask them to respect that this is the information, or excuse me, this is medical information, and that is really important that they keep this confidential and to themselves. And if they do feel like they should share it with others, to ask yours and your loved one's permission first. Perhaps you as a caregiver need as much help as possible, and like I mentioned, using those organizations, those online platforms such as My Cancer Circle and Lots of Helping Hands and even Meal Train could unite your friends and family to build a supportive and helpful community for you and your loved one. I also encourage caregivers to think about what brings them even the slightest bit of joy. And sometimes caregivers will note that various activities or even traditions brought them joy, but that they cannot do these anymore. So I often challenge caregivers by thinking about the activities or traditions that brought them joy and how could they incorporate them into their daily lives now. Think back to when I mentioned how we need to pencil in time into our calendar. Otherwise, sometimes it just won't. We just won't abide by our me time, if you will. So it's really important at this point to challenge yourself and think, well, where can I find like 30 minutes for myself today that'll bring me joy? And then in terms of traditions, if you and your family, for instance, take an annual beach trip, could you drive to your destination instead of flying if your loved one is immunocompromised? And lastly, if you or your loved one are ever unsure about an activity, never hesitate to talk to the medical team for their input. You may be surprised as they could tell you that certain activities are in fact safe, or if you feel very strongly about continuing with an activity with your loved one, you could always work with your medical team to figure out how to make it as safe as possible. Lastly, I also want to take the time to acknowledge that long-distance caregiving could be as, if not more, difficult than short-distance caregiving. You may not know how exactly to help your loved one because you live so far away. You could experience guilt for not being physically present. You may not be familiar with the local resources available to your loved one. And or you may experience burnout feelings, which are even valid for a long-distance caregiver, and oftentimes this does happen. So there are so many ways that you can still help as a long-distance caregiver. So again, going back to those online platforms like the My Cancer Circle or Meal Train, set that up for your loved one. See who in their area, maybe a neighbor or a friend, could help out, could take on some of the responsibility. Phone in when your loved one goes to doctor's appointments so that you can listen in on the conversation, and this actually may alleviate the stress for your loved one. Research and set up practical and emotional resources for your loved one, and set up check-ins via FaceTime, text, or phone call. We live in a day and age where this technology can really come in handy, so please use it to your advantage. Remember, all forms of caregiving aren't easy, so please be patient with yourself. I always encourage my caregivers to think about a couple of things. What are three admirable qualities that you have learned about yourself while caregiving? And lastly, I always encourage them to honor the sacrifice that you have made for your loved one and reflect upon how your values may have changed or stayed the same over time. And then finally, I do also want to touch upon Cancer Care's free services and resources. As Dr. Messner mentioned, I am the Caregiver Program Coordinator at Cancer Care, and we not only cater to caregivers and patients and bereaved folks through so many different ways, we have limited forms of financial assistance. We have live one-on-one or live group counseling services for New York and New Jersey residents. We also have online typing-based support groups for people nationwide. And yes, we do have many caregiver-focused support groups as well. It's completely free to join. We also have community-based programs. We have educational workshops, such as the one that you're in right now. We also have resource navigation, and this is more commonly known as case management, but we like to call it resource navigation because it's what it sounds like. We help you navigate resources local to your area. We also have a lot of educational material on our website, including a lot of information on clinical trials through our new online platform associated with cancer care called My Trialist. And we also have information about other cancer-based organizations. We have a large resource database, and we can find other organizations that either serve your area or your diagnosis to better help you. And with that, I will turn it back to my colleague, Dr. Messner.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Smith. That was really outstanding and just a wonderful presentation with a lot of important tips for caregivers, things to keep in mind, and giving out these great resources, which we will also include in the SurveyMonkey evaluation, as well as the phone number and website for cancer care. But we also include all of those wonderful resources that you provided as well. So that people will have, caregivers will have quite a bit of, will have all these resources at their fingertips. So thank you so much. And now we're going to move on to the Q&A, and I'm going to ask Rob to explain to you how to queue up for questions. Rob?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time we will take questions from the web only. You may submit questions by clicking Ask a Question.
So we have quite a few questions already. So the question for Dr. Prang, do you have any tips on keeping up with changes in the treatment plan?
That's a great question. I think a lot of these treatment regimens in lung cancer can involve several drugs at the same time, and more often than not, those drugs are all very different when we combine them. So, you know, some are given every week for 3 weeks and others are given once every 3 weeks. There's also other medications that we give that aren't necessarily for the cancer but can help strengthen bones, for example, and that's an injection that's given once every 4 weeks. So I think the best way to kind of keep up with the treatment plans is just to have them written out. That's a sort of a strategy that I've found can be useful, is sort of write out with your clinical team what drugs the patient is on. What are those purposes of the drugs? Are they to kill the cancer cells, or are they to boost the immune system, or are they to strengthen the bones? And when you kind of see them on paper, I think it's easier to get a sort of bird's eye view of all the different pieces of the treatment plan. And so I think that's one strategy I'd recommend, is really just to write everything out with the clinical team and why the patient is taking what drug and for what purpose.
Excellent. Thank you so much. And question again for you, Dr. Prang. Is there a way for a healthcare provider to tell if the cancer was caused by Agent Orange?
That's a good question. So I don't know the answer. I don't think there's a specific test for that. I think that really involves taking a very thorough history, meaning the oncologist asking you a lot of questions about where and when you were, how long you were possibly exposed to something. It's more of just some detective work with questions than it is a specific test, to my knowledge. I don't have expertise in this area, but so just to qualify.
Excellent. Thank you so much. So the question is a question you can go ahead and ask your healthcare team, see if they have anything more to add, but thanks, Dr. Prang. He's probably given you the same answer you're going to hear from your physician, but you never know, so go to your healthcare team and ask them as well. And then a question for Ms. James. Do you have any recommendations for how to handle our family members' anxiety prior to treatment and CT scans?
I know that some people will actually see their doctor, and they give them a, you know, a one-time dosage of something to help them be more calm when they're taking their scans. And also, they also couple that with reaching out to a therapist. And, of course, a patient navigator can help you manage that emotional side by connecting you to a therapist that's right here in your area. It doesn't always take medication. Sometimes it just takes talking through, but scanxiety is a very real thing. But I would definitely start with those two methods. If you would share with your doctor that you're having a lot of anxiety before the scans, they can definitely write you something for that. But I would also couple that with getting myself a counselor for the patient and the caregiver.
Excellent. Thank you. And Ms. Smith, do you want to add anything to that as well?
Ms. James basically said it all. You know, getting a counselor, I think, is so important because it helps you, it gives you an objective opinion rather than subjective from your family and friends. And there are so many affordable options out there. You know, you could definitely, for instance, look through your customer service at your insurance company to find one, so you're just paying a small copay. But again, as Ms. James said, very important to speak to a counselor.
So thank you so much. Thank you both, Ms. James and Ms. Smith. And I have a question for you, Ms. Smith. This is a longer question, so I'll read it, and if you could answer it in a general way. How can I make time for myself as a caregiver? My husband was diagnosed with early-stage non-small cell lung cancer and has been responding well to treatment for some time, but I still have many responsibilities. The past year, I've stopped thinking about myself and more about him and making sure he stays as healthy as possible. Now my health has been impacted, and I want to take time to go to the doctor or just do things for myself, but I'm still concerned about him. Could you comment on that, Ms. Smith?
Absolutely, yeah. So whenever I do work with caregivers, and I preface this by saying you are absolutely not alone in going through this type of experience where you're taking care of your loved one, and while they are doing well, you've kind of put aside your own wellness needs. But what I say to all my caregivers is that think about it this way. If something were to happen to you and you could no longer take care of your loved one in the way that you used to, that you were capable of doing, that would really impact both you and them. So that's why it's so important to put yourself first, take care of yourself first, and that means abiding by your own doctor's appointments. So this includes your primary care, your dentist, your endocrinologist or dermatologist, whoever you have in your medical team, abiding by those annual appointments. You can also think about it this way. If you feel very guilty as well, remember that if, you know, I always say, if you do not fill your own cup, how can you fill anyone else's cup? So just remember that putting yourself first, taking care of yourself, abiding by those appointments is not selfish. In fact, it's kind of selfless if you think about it. So please, please, please go and make that doctor's appointment.
Excellent. Thank you so much. A question for this is from a patient. I'm a non-small cell lung cancer patient, and I hate that my daughter has sacrificed so much to care for me. How can I seek help elsewhere without her feeling like I am ungrateful?
Did you say seeking help elsewhere?
I'm sorry. This is Ms. James. I am a non-small cell lung cancer patient, and I hate that my daughter has sacrificed so much to care for me. How can I seek help elsewhere without her feeling like I am ungrateful?
Oh, yeah, there are many, many services that I don't think your daughter would mind you getting help from. I don't think she would feel like you're ungrateful at all, like the custodial, you know, care services where they come in for a few hours, because there's never going to be anybody that's going to come in, you know, 24/7 on that type of service. But come in for a few hours. That way that gives your daughter time to do the things she needs to do, gives her a break. There's also your local area agency on aging. They have resources where people can come in for a few hours and help out in the house, respite services. These are things just designed for a few hours. So I think that your daughter would not mind at all about you seeking those services. And, of course, if you're looking for those services in your local area, just make sure you ask for a social worker or a patient navigator at your local healthcare facility, and they will connect you to someone who can tell you about all of these services in your area.
Well, thank you. And a question for Dr. Frang. My husband, diagnosed with stage 1B non-small cell lung cancer, still wants to go on our 25th anniversary trip to Italy. As his primary caregiver, I'm extremely hesitant. Should I try to get him to compromise, or should I trust that he's up for the trip?
Thanks for the question. I'm not sure where in the treatment timeline your husband is. The first thing I would say is I would just ask your oncologist. These are sort of, regardless of what stage lung cancer you have, the role of us medical oncologists is to make sure the treatment is provided in a timely manner, but that it doesn't prevent you from enjoying your life, right? I mean, the goal of treatment isn't to just hammer you with surgeries or radiation or treatment. It's to prolong or cure you so that you can continue to enjoy your life. So I think for generally speaking, unless something is really urgent, most of us would tailor the treatment plan around big trips like this that sound like they have a lot of value and meaning to you and your husband. So, I think I would talk to your oncologist and see if it's okay. I suspect it probably will be, because, again, a lot of this stuff can be moved around here and there for really important things in our patient and family's lives. So, I wish if I had more details, I could give you a better answer. But, it's one of those things where just because of the actual case, your oncologist will be able to tell you. But so let me just say this generally speaking. I think patients tend to be more cautious than they realize they can be. And on the flip side, usually us on the oncologist side are really happy to try to accommodate for these types of things. So always ask. Don't ever assume that you can't go on a vacation or because a treatment is scheduled for a Friday, you can't miss that and postpone it a week or two. Always, always ask, because I can tell you more often than not, the whole clinical team will rearrange the schedule so that you can participate in these really important activities.
Oh, excellent. Thank you so much, Dr. Prang. And I'm going to ask our speakers to provide takeaways. I have to say this has been an extraordinary call. I have to say there are both our speakers and the quality of the questions have been excellent as well, has made for a really wonderful program. So I'm going to ask to start with Dr. Prang, and if you would provide a takeaway for our participants from today's program.
Yeah, I would say, first of all, thanks for listening to everybody on this call. For taking the time. The biggest takeaway I would say is, your role is really, really invaluable, and it's hard. It really is. You have to be kind to yourself. And don't ever, ever underestimate how important it is to ask questions. Your oncologist is there to answer questions. And we have decades of experience, and this stuff is still complicated. You aren't expected to know anything. So There's never a dumb question, and you can ask the same question a million times, okay? So that would be the one big takeaway I would say is you're doing the oncologist a favor, and more importantly, you're doing the patient a favor by asking questions, questions, questions.
Oh, excellent. Thank you. That's such great advice. Thank you. And Ms. James, the takeaway from you?
I would just say give yourself grace and one day at a time.
Sounds good. Excellent. And thank you. And Ms. Smith?
Yeah, I truly second what Ms. James said. Be patient with yourself. And remember what I said in that caregiving can really feel and be a second job if you're already in a full-time job. So please be patient with yourself. Remember to seek support, whether from friends, family, medical or mental health professionals. Always remember to prioritize yourself because if you can't fill your own cup, how can you fill others? And last but not least, for my long-distance caregivers, remember everything that I mentioned and really use the internet to your advantage. FaceTime your loved ones, go on the internet, see what resources you can set up for them because it's so easy to care for someone even if they are not living in the same household as you.
Excellent. Wow. Well, I want to thank all of our speakers. You've just been phenomenal. And I want to thank all of our participants also for being on this call today and for asking such great questions. Now, I do want to comment that, of course, we have so many questions, we couldn't take all of your questions. So I'd like to comment on that. For those of you who asked a question, for those of you who are in queue hoping to get a question asked, and for those of you who are thinking of a question, all of you, please go back to your treating healthcare team. They know you the best. And I'm sure that they also, if you ask them the question, you've learned a lot from today's program. So take back what you've learned to your healthcare team and ask them the question again. And I think as Dr. Frank said, ask that question over and over and over again. It's fine. And so be sure to do that. And also, they also, remember your healthcare team knows you the best. They have your healthcare records in front of them, and they can be incredibly helpful. Also, as has been pointed out, your healthcare team consists not only of your oncologist, but it also consists of other members of the healthcare team, an oncology nurse, oncology social worker, a resource navigator, a patient navigator, financial navigator. So there are lots of people on that team who can really help you. So if you ask a question of your physician, they may very well answer it in part and then refer you to other members of the team for your help. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop, and you may now disconnect. Everyone, have a great day.